It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. One word that has remained through the pandemic, whether it was for essential businesses during the shutdown or as others gradually reopened, is safety. Safety for workers and customers. During the first 4 months of the pandemic, employees at 63 companies in the Pittsburgh region filed about 100 complaints related to COVID-19 concerns with OSHA. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporters Kate Giamarisi and Daniel Moore have been examining those complaints. Kate, give us an idea of the type of concerns that were raised by workers in our area.
Having read through, you know, dozens and dozens of these complaints that workers made to OSHA, the primary issue was workers were complaining about the lack of PPE, the lack of that personal protective equipment. Primarily, they were complaining about there not being enough masks, having to reuse masks. There was also some complaints about workplaces not following social distancing guidelines or, you know, not maintaining proper hygiene, things like not enough soap.
Daniel, not enough equipment. What about the process, the actual conditions at maybe some of the work sites themselves?
You know, these challenges extended to businesses large and small. I mean, we're talking everything from large manufacturing plants to small mom-and-pop retail shops. I mean, we saw a few candle shops on there, the Bettis Atomic Laboratory. And it was kind of interesting to watch it play out through May and June, watch the complaints play out, because you started to see a lot of restaurants and a lot of, you know, casinos that reopened start to see complaints filed by employees of customers not wearing masks, of coworkers not wearing masks, of there being still supply shortages even as the economy began to reopen.
And you found out that even a lab where tests were being processed, there was a complaint about cleanliness there?
Right, yeah. This was a Quest Diagnostics lab in Greentree. And this was early on in the pandemic. I believe it was late March. And there were some issues with sanitation throughout the building and employees not wearing masks when they were handling these samples. So it kind of shows you the degree to which that businesses, even those in healthcare, even those handling the samples, were struggling to comply and to, you know, make sure that there was enough supplies on hand to keep employees safe.
Daniel, I mentioned about 63 companies, organizations, had complaints filed. Do we know how many employees were exposed or could have been exposed?
The alleged violations potentially exposed a total of almost 5,900 workers in the region.
All right, OSHA receives these complaints from workers in the Pittsburgh area. What action did they take in response to these concerns?
Yeah, so OSHA did not respond to specific questions for this story, but they've pointed out that the safety concerns have actually affected their inspection. So, you know, OSHA has actually relied on phone calls, video meetings, virtual inspections of workplaces during the pandemic. It has not, however, put into place any kind of standard, an emergency standard, which is something that unions have been pushing for, which would legally require employers to follow a set of guidelines, essentially, that have legal teeth. So OSHA's response has been largely to issue guidelines that are voluntary. You know, when they get complaints, they reach out to the employer, they let them know that there's been a complaint filed, and they try to resolve the issue.
To either of you, for your reporting, you spoke with David Michaels, former head of OSHA. What was his reaction to his former agency's response?
Well, Mr. Michaels, has been very public and very open in his criticism of the agency and, you know, has repeatedly made the point that this agency is not using the most powerful tool at its disposal, and that's that emergency temporary standard. The quote that he gave us for our story is, you know, something along the lines of they're treating this as business as usual.
no further action is expected? And also, what do you still hope to learn? What questions do you have remaining?
I would go back to the emergency temporary standard and whether OSHA does take any additional action, because the complaints, as we saw in the data, are not slowing down. In some industries like restaurants, casinos, we're seeing more complaints at those workplaces. So as the pandemic stays with us for months and months, I would be interested to see if OSHA does end up taking any kind of stronger enforcement action.
Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporters Kate Giamarisi and Daniel Moore, thanks so much for your time and thanks for your good work.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Modernity, lightness, and stylishness, that's the message that U.S. Steel wanted to convey when it introduced the steel mark as its logo. In 1962, the three hypocycloids, diamonds, first appeared on the helmets of the Pittsburgh Steelers. The steel mark still represents a city, a team, and an industry, but it does not carry the legacy of racism that is forcing other teams to rethink their logos and change their names. Ari Lightman is a professor at the Heinz College of Carnegie Mellon University. He teaches students to work with companies to develop responses to social initiatives. Ari, let's start with the NFL team in Washington, D.C. has announced they will be known as the Washington Football Team for one season until a new name is selected. Their previous name and logo considered by many to be racial slurs against Native Americans. Owner Daniel Snyder has resisted changing the name for years. From your experience, why do businesses or organizations hold on to a symbol like that?
They've invested a lot of money. There's a lot of recollection associated with it based on different categories of fans.
And the fans, are they buying into, when they buy jerseys and hats that bear that name, that logo, are they buying into more than just a sports team?
Absolutely. That all has to be taken into consideration. The big question, Kevin, is, to what extent is the association with the name or the association with the team and the history of the team, those sorts of things? And I think that's one of the things that owners are struggling with.
The Cleveland Indians are also considering a name change, but at this point, the Atlanta Braves and Kansas City Chiefs are not. So in 2020, how should a team respond to a groundswell of outrage even over a name or logo that many feels not only out of date but offensive?
Well, we have to take into consideration that this has been going on for a long period of time. The Redskins, though, is a unique case in the sense that that is considered a racial slur. And we also have college teams, right? So let's take Florida State Seminoles. That's named after a specific tribe. And, you know, the organization is known for going out and outreach to the community and doing things for the Seminole Nation. And I don't know whether other teams that are out there are doing that same consideration.
You mentioned colleges. Well, nearly 50 years ago, Stanford removed the Indian team name and logo, switching to the Cardinal. St. John's switched from the Redmen to the Red Storm in 1994. What about colleges? How important is it for them to reconsider their team names and logos, whether it's the Florida State Seminoles, the Utah Utes, et cetera?
It's really going to come down to leverage. Unfortunately, that's the case these days. If you look at a large NFL team, they do have the amount of resources in place to do a very large name change. College teams may not. High school teams probably most likely do not as well. I don't want to sound heartless, but that's sometimes what it comes down to. Understanding what is the economic ramification associated with making this major name change.
There could be a positive economic ramification. I mean, if you change your name, your logo, that's an opportunity for new jerseys, new shirts, new hats, new paraphernalia that fans might just scoop up and buy.
Yeah, that's right. By the process of being more inclusive and going through a name change, can that bring in new populations that were once disenfranchised from the organization based on their name? And that's what a lot of NFL teams are thinking about as well. right? As they expand into new territories and look at different rights associated with their content for their games, as well as merchandise, I doubt it highly that they'll alienate fans. And what they would do is bring in new fans.
In general, if a logo, if a nickname is not considered to be controversial, offensive, should a team try to stick with one identity generation after generation, such as the Steelers?
Well, that's tough, Kevin, because, you know, I'm in Pittsburgh. I'm a huge Steeler fan. I grew up a Steeler fan, even though I grew up in Ohio. So there's a huge tradition and identity associated with the Steelers. But I think teams that alienate specific populations because their name might be construed as a racial slight to a specific population really need to think about their identity, right? In an era where we have a lot of social injustice, but until it makes an economic case for them, I think we're going to see a lot of resistance associated with doing it.
Ari Lightman is professor of digital media and marketing at Carnegie Mellon University. Ari, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Real-Time Interventions, a local live arts production company focused on creating human connection through empathy, is continuing its live streaming program, Real-Time Presents Associate Episode 2, Thursday, August 5th at 7 p.m., presented through City of Asylum's The Show Must Go Online virtual channel. 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker talked with the co-founders of Real-Time Interventions, along with one of the participating artists.
I am joined by Molly Rice and Rusty Thielen. They are Real-Time Interventions. Rusty, Molly, thank you very much for joining me. Socially distant here.
We're glad to be here, Bob.
Let me ask you to start with just an overall discussion of the concept of what you have coming up on the 5th of August.
We are doing the second episode of a new show that we put together in response to our audience's preferences. They said they wanted a show that was no longer than an hour, something that made them feel connected. And we realized there were real possibilities, so we created a show called Associate. Part of the show is that audiences free associate with the guest artists, and then we have a final artist that creates something from those associations throughout the hour and presents it at the end.
So we can consider this something where the audiences absolutely can be considered co-creators.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah. It's really fun to see because, you know, at the end, we'll talk a little bit about that final piece and audiences get to see a little bit of what they've contributed in that final piece.
Now, you're also directing all of your efforts towards being in solidarity with the Black Lives Matters movement, correct?
That's right. We made the decision to sort of center Black artists for the rest of our season, basically. We felt like there's a lot of discussion and a lot of talking going on right now, and we wanted to move past that just to action. And it seemed really clear to us that this was something that we had to offer up. We have the platform to offer it, so why not take advantage of that?
Let me ask you to give me just a quick thumbnail sketch of what people will experience when they log on and check this out.
So basically, when the audience joins the platform, there will be artists there that will be responding to prompts by free association. And the audience will use the chat to join in and offer their associations to these prompts. So we spend about 10, maybe 15 minutes doing that. And then what we're going to do is focus on each of our guest associator artists, asking, is there a piece of work that was deeply inspired by the spirit of association, free association, or is there a piece that surprised you in its development? And we will showcase a work from each of them. And then we'll come back around and introduce that fourth artist who will have been listening in and using all of those associations to create a new piece.
So
in the moment.
Okay, so essentially you have four different people participating with you, three of them doing free association, the fourth listening to everything and including what the audience contributes via chat and coming up with an original artistic expression at the end of the presentation.
That's right. It's part talk show, part happening, and part co-creation experience.
And one of the participants is Dr. Aaron Johnson from the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Johnson, thank you very much for joining the conversation here.
You're welcome.
How will you take your field of expertise and plug it into the event that's going to happen on the 5th of August?
Well, I'm still a jazz musician, so improvisation is what I do, and that's what I'll do.
Rusty, Molly, can you weigh in a little bit on how you'll try to facilitate Dr. Johnson's participation?
I'll take a stab at that. Improvisation is definitely deeply tied to this sort of creativity and the subconscious. So we're super thrilled to have a jazz musician and artist as part of this. We're just really thrilled to see where the meandering mind goes.
Now, let me ask you to talk specifically about how your solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement will work with this particular presentation.
Well, all of our programming since the end of May has featured Black artists and Black leaders in our communities. We have made a couple of pivots since the middle of March when our show Karaki closed down due to the COVID virus, and those pivots have been based on surveys we've done of our audiences, but also what we in our hearts know need to be changes in the arts community. And we are really trying to use this moment to question liveness, live performance, and to lean into new forms that are not only inclusive of all voices, but also are innovative and that meet the moment. And that includes all of the crises we're going through right now.
Dr. Johnson, let me ask you to weigh in here on how you will bring your life experiences to a project like this.
You know, jazz is speaks in many registers, and one of the most important registers has always been its dialogue with the African-American life and the American experience. I've been doing that because I've been playing jazz and funk my entire life, and that's what we do.
Thanks to Molly Rice and Rusty Thielen, co-founders of Real Time Interventions, and Dr. Aaron Johnson for explaining what will happen when they, along with playwright T.J. Young, illustrator Marcel L. Walker, and interdisciplinary artist Zell Miller III will swim in the subconscious and, with the help from a very involved online audience, create something nobody could have predicted. Next week, during Associate, Episode 2. For The Confluence, I'm Bob Studebaker.
Associate Episode 2 will be presented Thursday, August 5th at 7 p.m. at City of Asylum's shared programming channel, The Show Must Go On Line. You can find it at their website, alphabetcity.org. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.